I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. Listen to this list. XTC, Susie and the Banshees, Simple Minds, The Psychedelic Furs, Talking Heads, U2, The Rolling Stones, The Pogues, Steel Pulse, Peter Gabriel, Morrissey, The Killers, Dave Matthews Band, and Joan Arma Trading. My guest today has collaborated with all of them. He has credits on over 500 records. So settle in for my chat with the legendary producer, Steve Lillywhite. Hello there, Steve. Can you give me a wee 1-2 for the sound check?
Hello there, Frank. My name's Steve Lillywhite, and I'm a commander of the British Empire.
Oh, my goodness. Thank God there's a lot of miles between us. I don't know if I could be in the same room with a man like that.
How the devil are you, Mr. Frank?
I'm fabulous, Steve.
I know you are. You're a legend.
I'm in San Francisco. And where are you this evening?
I'm on the island of... I'm in the city of Jakarta on the island of Java in the country of Indonesia.
That's fabulous. Isn't technology great?
As probably a lot of Americans who are not so great at their geography, it's the fourth largest country in the world. It's the largest congregation of Muslims anywhere on the planet, although it's not a Muslim country. It's a democracy. But just under 90% of the population are Muslim, about 8% are Christian, throw in a few Buddhists and a few Hindu, and that's what you've got. Wow. Most of the politicians are Muslim because it's a democracy and people tend to vote that way. Although Jakarta did have a Christian mayor who was very good for a while. But no, it's great. I basically moved here because I was living in Hollywood and I was seeing the American and Western music business. And I'd just gone maybe 40 years or so there. And I was losing interest in the sort of music that was coming out. And I just felt I need my whole being has been based on my enthusiasm. You know, and I was just not feeling that enthusiastic about new music that was coming out. It was, you know, all the hit records were being typed rather than played.
Yeah.
And I didn't enter the music business to become a typist, you know. So I thought I came over here to do a few tracks with the band and ended up loving it and stayed here. And now it's, you know, it has its own whole culture here. They have their own rock stars. They have their own scandals. They have, you know, and I feel very at home here now, actually. Very at home.
It sounds like a plan.
It is a plan, but don't tell too many of your friends because I'm special, because I'm one of the few foreigners who live here.
Yeah, I've actually been to Jakarta, and I remember.
You have, yeah. So, you know, they're beautiful. They're lovely, lovely people. They do anything for you. You know, they're very friendly. And really, the Christians and the Muslims coexist in a great way, you know. And there's no political divide in this country either at the moment. At the point of interview, Mr. Gallagher, right. At the point of interview, there is no political divide.
Brilliant.
But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're talking about Penny and Giles and Knobs and Faders like that, right?
Well, no, not really. No, this is
not so much a technical
discussion. I want to find out where Steve Lillywhite first became aware of sound, and specifically sound in relation to music.
Okay, well...
Because your background, you know, I can read all I want, but I've never heard the story, really.
Yeah. Well, it's very... let me say that with a name like Lillywhite, with no pedigree, you are never going to be the cool guy. And I was not the cool guy to start with. I mean, I was ridiculed at school. I was, Lily White is not a manly name, so I was considered of a different persuasion in those days when it was, you know, everything that you could throw at a schoolboy, you know, because schoolboys can be vicious, you know, schoolgirls can, kids can be vicious as well. I was thrown at. So I was definitely the uncool kid in class. And it was only when, but then my friend got a guitar and said, do you want to learn the bass? Then we can form a band. So I learned the bass. We formed a band. We had a little bit of local success. I was only 16 or so. But really, in terms of sound, even before then, I remember lying in bed and my parents, who were, you know, who were pretty cool, because my mum was only 20 when she had me. So, you know, definitely post-war 60s mum, you know, and she was pretty hot for, you know, for a mum. You know, they would listen to some modern music or what they liked, and I would be in bed and I would hear the bass coming up. So I sort of loved the bass all that time, because, you know, through a wall, you don't hear the treble, you just hear the bottom end. And so that was my first sort of real thought about sound. And I would be half asleep hearing these bass lines. But then when I started playing the bass and got in the band, all of a sudden I was never the cool guy at school, but I was in the band, and I did manage to get a couple of girlfriends, and I was very lucky to get a job in a studio when I was 17, because I was not the sort of person you could look at the school photograph and go that, or look at my reports. And, you know, I was not one of those people, probably like, unlike you, Frank, who was busy with the screwdriver, taking apart transistor radios and putting them back together again, all that stuff. I never did, you know, I was not that sort of a guy. I was a complete space cadet. You know, I mean, my head was in the clouds from any moment I remember, and I still, living in the moment is still my biggest challenge in life. And I mean, I'm much better at it now, but you know, from the age of 14, I was stoned all the time, you know. And certainly, yeah, living in the moment is very important to me. So that's got nothing to do with sound. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Did you pick up an instrument at an early age?
Yeah. You didn't listen to a thing I said, did
not
you?
Not much.
You didn't listen to a thing I said, because I said I was a fucking bass player.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not a musician. I'll cut that bit out. Anyway.
Oh, no, don't cut that bit out. That's a great bit. No, don't cut anything out.
I'm just getting up to speed here.
No, I was a bass player, and I was in a band, and it was from the moment I picked up the bass that I suddenly, you know, I got this music bug, and I was obsessive even in those days. And I remember just sitting there on my own night after night, practicing, putting in my 10,000 hours, you know, on my own. You know, I've never had a problem doing that sort of concentration thing. On one thing, you know, which is why, as a producer, you know, I've never had a problem spending a month on 3 minutes of music. It's just seems like perfectly okay to me. It's like sculpting, you know. So maybe I'm a little bit on the spectrum, but it's difficult to know. I mean, I sort of look back on my life and go, well, I think I'm completely normal, but when I look back at my actions, I think, well, maybe I'm not as normal as I thought, you know. But that's only from looking; it's not from feelings. In my feelings, I'm just completely normal. But when I look at my actions, you know, like deciding on a whim to move to Indonesia, you know, I mean, that's not what, maybe not what normal people do. I don't know what normal people do, but yeah. But I got the bass, And then I got the job in the recording studio, and I was off to the races. I didn't even finish high school. I went straight from you know, I didn't get enough O levels to go into the sixth form, and then I got straight a job when I was 17. You know, so I was very, very young when I started, but my enthusiasm was everything for me. You know.
And how what kind of bands did you start going out to see and buying tickets for, and also aware of the live sound, which was probably what you were first introduced to, apart from
Europe. That was everything. I always look at punk rock as being a sort of a point in my life that was a changing point, because before punk rock, I had the sort of music I loved. Well, let's go back to even school days. If you were into music, you were either a Melody Maker or an NME or a Sounds. If you were into NME, it was sort of indie. If you were into Sounds, it was more heavy rock. And if you were into Melody Maker in those days, it was sort of more bluesy rock. And I was a Melody Maker guy. I loved, and Melody Maker in those days used to have their own blues concerts, which they put on. They'd bring in these great American blues artists and put on their gigs, and I would always go to those. But also, I like very weird folk, sort of folk rock. There's and I went down a sort of Spotify journey the other day, listening to all these crazy records that I loved. And the weird thing is, you know, the great thing about music is that you can still remember every single fucking thing about these records, even if you haven't heard them for many, many years. I mean, there was a band called Stackridge, Cook.
I worked with Stackridge.
You are joking.
No, I did a few gigs with Stackridge, yep.
Oh my God!
I don't remember it as well as you. we opened for Greenslade.
You opened for Greenslade. That's
at the Roundhouse. I was one of them. Yeah, you're bringing it back to me. I don't know how I remembered that, because then I was very stoned too.
Exactly, but wasn't the Roundhouse a fantastic gig?
Fantastic.
Oh, I love that place. I love that place. The only time, Frank Gallagher, I have ever done live sound was at the Roundhouse, and I realized it was so bad. I just produced Ultravox's co-produced their first album, either their first or second album, but they did a gig at the Roundhouse and they didn't have a sound guy because it was early days. And I said, and they said, Steve, would you do the live sound for us? And I said, sure. So, I mean, it's a whole different animal. There was so much feedback. It was an absolute disaster. So that's the only time I've ever done that. I mean, been the man on the faders. I've been the man next to the man on the faders, giving instructions, and that's a much better way. But I was just fucking useless, you know, because I think live sound has a different balance anyway. I think you have to do different, you know. I think a live mix is a different balance in terms of getting the power across to the audience than a record.
Oh yeah, and there's no feedback in the studio, and the live thing you only get one take, and it's
you
about
do, yeah,
it's
yeah,
about
but
gain structure.
It's gain
structure and balancing what's coming off the stage with what's coming out of the speakers and getting that sound reinforcement basically. Which brings me to what studio did you get into as a boy?
Okay. So I left school and very luckily got a job at, it was called Phonogram Studios when I started, but it got its reputation and it was called Philips Studios. And it was, when it got its reputation, it did a lot of sort of Walker Brothers, Dusty Springfield, these big open sounding, slightly Spectre-esque UK records, you know, and they were great records. And then when I joined the studio, the studio had a refurbish because this was in 72, and they decided to go completely dead because, you know, this was at the time where if you had, you know, what everyone was aiming for was complete isolation on each instrument. They didn't understand the art of the room mic, or they thought that you know, they were aiming to have everything so you could structure each individual sound how you wanted to. But of course, all the great records that were done at my studio were all done with a lot of spill, not even room mics, just spill, because everything was getting into every other mic, you know. But of course, they thought, that's not right. Let's try and make it, you know. So it wasn't quite so good. But even so, I did I tape opted and engineered on records as diverse as Val Dunican, Harry Secombe, to Status Quo and Wizard.
That's a quite an eclectic mix. Did that studio become IBC? Did that become
No. It actually became Solid Bond. Paul Weller bought it. Ah. It was right. It was probably the most prime real estate in London, literally on Marble Arch, right on the corner of Marble Arch and Oxford Street, right near, very near Pye.
Uh-huh.
No, IBC, that was very funny, because IBC was near all the embassies. And in fact, I got told a story by Status Quo that you could hear sometimes when you were in the studio at IBC, you could hear the secret telephone messages being transmitted from the Chinese embassy back to China, and it would come through the speakers. You know, it was, I don't know. You see, again, that's just something I've just remembered, and I don't think I've ever said that.
So, you do, in England, they have a much different attitude towards being a recording engineer. First of all, you got to do an apprenticeship, and you got to be a tape op. And
in those days,
you got to make tea.
Yeah, I started out as a tea boy. That was absolutely the case. But unlike a lot of American studios, they would have a three layers. You would have an assistant who was the T-boy as well, but he would press the buttons. You would have the engineer and the producer. I've noticed American studios would have four levels. The T-boy was literally a runner. You know, the first job you get in a big American studio is nothing to do with being anything to do with music. It's to do with going to get tea, getting the drinks, helping the load in, all that stuff. And you might do that for a year before you even get to sit on a session. At least, you know, with me, I managed to get in on a session straight away and start learning. So by the time punk came up in 77, I was going to all the gigs and I managed to get my first break.
What was it?
My first album was Ultravox, and then I did an album with a guy called Johnny Thunders, and then through Johnny Thunders, I got asked to do the first Susie and the Banshees album. First Susie and the Banshees single, which was called Hong Kong Garden, and of course, you know, that was a hit, and the moment you get a hit, you get the work. You know, and that was it. It's like a catch-22. How do you get the hit if you don't get the work? But you need the work to get the hit. And all of a sudden, there was this wave called punk rock, which I rode, and have managed to sort of keep surfing ever since, really.
And so, what was your most memorable live gig before you got into making records yourself? What was the what formed your feel and your ear? Well, obviously, was good.
Okay, two gigs: the Vanilla Fudge at the Marquee Club, because Vanilla Fudge were, I always remember this, it was loudest band in the world. It was. It was announced at on the flyer, and it was fucking loud, you know. And still I remember, "Set me free, why don't you, babe? Keep me hanging on." Their version of that song is fucking brilliant.
I mean, it's heavy. It's heavy.
It's heavy. It's really heavy. I mean, it's a great song by anyone, you know, but the way they do it, they do it really slow and grind it out. So that gig was really amazing for me. But I remember when I was 14 going to see Blind Faith at Hyde Park. Which again was fantastic. Blind Faith, and then the following week, the Rolling Stones at Hyde Park, which was the famous Rolling Stones gig where Mick let off the butterflies for Brian Jones, who just died.
Yeah, I remember that. I wasn't there, but I remember it.
Yeah. Well, those two gigs, and I was only 14. It was in 1969, so I can't believe my mum let me go. But me and a couple of mates went the day. And then, you know, I used to go to Reading Festival because that was near where I lived, and camp out there. And that was, you know, that was a great rite of passage as well. You know, so I loved live music, and I still do. One of my absolute prerequisites for producing anyone, Frank, is that I have to see them live before I go in the studio, if I can. Because my theory is I can listen to all their albums, but I've got no idea how those albums came about. But if I go and see them live, I see them when they're not thinking. I see them perform when it's pure joy and when it's just them, you know, without anyone else being involved. No producer, no, you know, and I always think an artist performs best live. So I always want to try and put them in a mental place in the studio where they are playing as if they're playing live, or as if they're, you know, it's their best ever show. You know, and that's, you know, and sometimes I've succeeded and sometimes I've fallen flat on my ass. but that's how I see it. You know, I mean, for me, live is, you know, I do have a liking for musicians interacting together. Yeah. I mean, I've always equated it to, you know, when you see a flock of birds in the sky and they all move at the same time. For me, that's what a great band is, when they're, you know, they don't, it's sort of loose, but they just instinctively know how to do it all at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. Right? A good line.
Do you know what I mean? Do you get that? I remember
absolutely.
Saying that. And that is especially true with these sort of jam bands. I work with a band called Phish, P-H-I-S-H, not the lead singer of Marillion, who's a very nice chap.
I terrorized that man. I did. I'll tell you a story. Yeah, I kept popping up when I was with Simple Minds. He'd show up, and he never knew who I was, and I would just terrorize him, and nobody would tell him who I was. We kept it going for a few days. It was great. But riddle me this: going back to your early days, were you aware of the transition that the live sound systems were making? They were going from very primitive to having Penny and Giles faders to having fold back to having good microphones and to the modern days for bands you've produced. You've seen very large sound systems grow.
Exponentially.
Yes.
Yes, they have really got crazy. No, I'm not. I'm very much a touchy-feely guy. I try not to analyze. Well, it's weird. I do analyze a lot, but maybe in my own way. No, the only time I ever really noticed, I mean, actually, to be honest, I noticed a big difference in how people play when they started to use in-ears.
Yeah.
And for me, there's nothing worse than a band playing a small club using in-ears and a click track. I mean, for them to really, I mean, it's just the chances of it being a great gig for me are a lot less than just them playing themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of...
You know, a click track can absolutely... Now, you two use a click track on every single song, but they make up for it with all the visuals and all, you know, all that stuff. But there's something about free music that just play. Even the Rolling Stones use a click track on two songs, even now. You know, the rest of the set is just the band playing, and that's Keith. You know, I mean, you know, Keith's the Luddite in that band, and that's the one element of his Ludditeness that is still actually very, very commendable.
Yeah.
But you know, when I see a band, and what's on the click track, it's just fucking like some keyboard pad or something. I mean, it means nothing, but what it's bringing down in the whole sound is much greater than what that keyboard pad is giving the sound to the audience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's.
I mean, I don't know. I think I believe that. I mean, not every time, but you know, I've seen so many bands who do that, and they're playing a small club, and it's, you know, everything is metronomic. It doesn't get faster.
It's no humanity. There's no humanity.
It's no, exactly. Music should feel and it should breathe. Live music, especially.
I'd love.
You know, because
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Frank.
I'd love to mix the Stones. Their guy still has an old analog Yamaha 4K that he.
Oh really?
Yeah, he takes his own 4K with him. I've heard some really iffy Stones mixes over the years because you know Buddy
of
Guy.
Course.
We toured with them and I've been around them. And it's so simple. It's a rock and roll band. It's a bar band.
Yeah.
Make it louder. It's so simple, but people over-process it. And
they do.
Because I look at the rigs. I go up and look at the stuff, and I'm going, what the fuck do you need that for? It's a four-piece bar band at basic, you know?
Yeah,
And the rest of it's waffle. Anyway.
Yeah. Although I have to say, Joe has done a fantastic job with you two over the years. His humbleness has kept him where he is today, you know, and he's done a great job. I mean, sometimes the sound has not been fantastic, but he's embraced what he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes Joe O'Herlihy so, so great.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that job because that scaled up pretty quick. You know, you two were talking, he had his opening act at one point too. And I think Joe might have been with them then.
Joe's been with them since before me.
Joe, this was 78. I mean, I think it was our Talking Heads second tour of Europe. I think we did a
couple. Was that before U2's first album then?
Oh, yeah, they had a single up.
Oh, okay.
It was like a CBS thing. I think it was CBS.
Right. Yeah, it's called, U2-3 it was called.
I remember the cover. McGuinness and Bono and I closed the Portobello Hotel. Well, we didn't close it. We sat there for a while. So you learned your skill. Was it predominantly Neve desks and stuff back then? That you learned on?
No, I've always said I've made the best records in the worst studios and the worst records in the best studios. I suppose the two studios I've done the most success on in terms of the UK has been the SSL in Studio 2 at the Townhouse, which was one of the very early SSLs, but also the API at Rack, which, you know, I don't know, it's... I used to literally choose studios on two prerequisites. One, if it was near where I lived, and if it had a table tennis table. I mean, those were the two things that I really cared about, you know, and I thought, well, everything else I can, you know, it's my fault if it's not a good record. It's not, I'll never blame the studio because I'm a lover of studio culture. You know, studio culture for me was what got, you know, the whole, and now there is no studio culture.
No.
And I'm not blaming, you know, I'm not complaining. It's just that I was lucky that I grew up in that world. You know, I think it's fantastic that people can make Sgt. Pepper's on a laptop at home if they so desire. But, you know, if I didn't do that for me, it was, I'm glad I had my era, because I think I suited my era. I don't think I suit the new era of record making as much as I did in those days. So I do like APIs. I like the EQ because it's very simple. It's just on a click. So you know, in terms of just doing a recall, it's easy. I think, you know, you have to be master of your own equipment. I mean, I remember when the SSL 9000 came out. I it's just too big for me, and I just didn't feel. I felt like it owned me. I didn't own it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And there's I even my studio with Kirsty. I had an AMEC Angela, which I loved as well. Just very simple.
Yeah, you know. That's all you need is if you've got a couple of good mics and a good source.
Yeah.
What else do you need?
Yeah, exactly.
See, I was a vibe merchant too, which young Kerr called me.
Well, I know.
I was never a technocrat, because here's the deal. When I came to America, we didn't have house systems in England. We used to take a PA in England. So I knew what I was using every night if I was traveling with a PA company and you know, doing the headliner and usually the support for a tenner. You know, or a bit of hash or something, but when I came to America and it was house systems, I had to roll up it to whatever was there. I didn't have a choice, and that's where I learned my craft was dealing with rotary pots, with stuff that was nailed together, and you just had to get on with it.
Yeah, but you're underestimating yourself when you call yourself a vibe merchant.
Oh.
You know, you are, because there's more to it than that. That is a part of it, and to the unintelligent, because Jim Kerr is not unintelligent, but on the surface, that's what people think you are. And the same with me. But underneath, there has to be, you have to be able to back up your your good vibes.
The organic, you know, the organic part of it.
Yeah, yeah, you don't get asked back. Well, this is what I said to Bono. I said, Bono, look, I'm a nice guy and I know you like me, but why do you keep asking me back? And it's the same with you. You've got long-term clients, Frank. Why do they always want you if you're just a vibe merchant? And what Bono said to me, he said, Steve, clarity. You, and I don't think I've got clarity at all, but Bono, I've managed to fool Bono into thinking I've got clarity. But there you go.
It's put my
children through college. So
yes.
I'm glad for that.
Yes, it's funny because Frank Murray, God rest his soul, who managed the Pogues. I met Frank in 1972.
Lizzie. Beautiful also first wife.
Sorry?
And my first wife, of course.
Of course, Kirsty. I think I was indirectly responsible for you meeting her. With Simple Minds.
I know exactly how I'm... Well, because you didn't have any cocaine that night.
That's probably why. And
literally, that's how I met her, when she brought some coke down to the studio for us.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. God rest her soul.
God love her. Yeah. But you've been involved with a lot of bands that I have a history with too. You know, I helped Frank Murray with the Pogues at one point, and Talking Heads, XTC, who toured with Talking Heads.
I didn't know you did XTC.
No,
yeah.
I didn't do them. They were our opening act, but I got to know them very well.
Very good.
Members who I toured America with on that Working Girl record. And when your brother stayed home
with my brother.
So we've had some parallel paths, even though we didn't bump into each other. What was you said Susie was the first hit you had. Did you do anything before you produce anything? How did you graduate from engineering to the producer's chair?
I if you do listen back, Frank, you will hear that I did explain the link between my first hit. Anyway, let's go back. I produced Ultravox, and that was my first production. It was a three-way production between me, Brian Eno, and U2, and Ultravox. And then my roommate at the time knew Johnny Thunders, Johnny Thunders from the New York Dolls had just come to England. He had a band called the Heartbreakers, who had an album called LAMF.
Yeah.
Johnny was about to do a solo album. I put my hand up and said, I'll record your solo album for you. I'd also worked on Eddie and the Hot Rods, Do Anything You Want to Do, but not really, just as engineer. But I was on the scene. So I recorded Johnny's album. And during the recording, Susie and the Banshees manager came to the studio, liked the drum sound of a song called You Can't Put Your Arms Around a Memory, which is actually a great, great song.
I have a history with Thunders.
You have a history with Thunders. Well, I did his greatest ever. I produced So Alone. And then I did Hong Kong Garden, you know. So what's your history with Thunders?
Oh, well, I booked him at Irving Plaza a few times, but his manager called me and said, I've got this box of outtakes and cassettes from Irving Plaza, some of which I had recorded. And at that time in New York, there was a cassette-only label called Roar Records, and they only made cassettes. Right. And I put together a Thunders compilation, and I took Johnny in the studio with me, and we were just cleaning. I mean, it was damage control. These things were recorded on fucking aluminum foil with a knitting needle. You know, I'd clean it up and I'd sequence it and put it together. And I'd say to Johnny, what do you think? He'd say, yeah, great, great. Because all he wanted to do, Johnny, was take drugs. You know, I just finished Walter Lure's book.
Walter just died.
Waldo, yeah.
He did, didn't he? Yeah. I loved Walter. He was a lovely man.
Well, you know, I was a New Yorker for many years, so I got to know all those dudes. Anyway, so Thunders, I don't even have a copy of that. I was listed as producer, and you know, and I was going, oh, do I want my name on this? Because it was a cassette made from cassettes, like third generation. But as a historical document, I'm sure somebody's got one somewhere. I should grab it.
That's so funny. I wonder if that was before I did So Alone or after?
When
did you do this?
I did this in the mid-80s.
Oh, mid-80s, so well after.
Yeah. Johnny at that point was, shall we say, not on the ascendancy.
No. Oh, I mean, it was an accident waiting to happen.
But I booked him at Irving Plaza, and he would come in. He didn't own an amp. We'd get an amp for him. He had a guitar. He had no cable, but he always managed. He'd never hocked his guitar, so he always had that because that was the only way he could make a dollar. And he would always advance whatever we were paying him would be gone before he got to soundcheck because he'd advance all of it and spend it, you know. But at least he would show up. But when he plugged in, he was Johnny Thunders. That was it.
Yeah. No, he was certainly what you got on the tin was what you got.
Lovely man.
He was lovely. I loved Walter though. Walter was just a
Walter's a very smart, funny guy too.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was great. And Billy Rath, he was the bass player. No, the album I did with him was fantastic. We had Phil Lynott, we had Stevie Marriott, we had Paul and we had the Hot Rods, Paul and Steve from Eddie and the Hot Rods, bass and drums. We had Steve Jones and Paul Cook from the Sex Pistols. It was a Peter Parrott from The Only Ones was very influential on that album. So it was a pretty, you know, pretty crazy record.
I loved punk. I must say I loved I loved punk.
Well, for me, punk was my leap, you know, that was my takeoff point. But you know, I did realize punk as an attitude was fantastic. But punk as a musical art form, I always felt was limited, you know. Certainly limited in terms of trying to have a career where you didn't have to ever really have a proper job. So whenever I always tried to look at more of the art side of it, you know, so I never worked with those really guttural sounding punk bands, you know. I always much more, you know, I went for the members because they had irony. I went for XTC because they had musicianship. I went for the Psychedelic Furs because, you know, it was Richard, to be honest, Richard Butler's just wonderful voice and beautiful chaos. I loved their catchphrase, you know. So, but I never did the sort of something dogs, you know, those Sham 69. I never worked with them. I never worked with. I didn't like that. I like the. I like the more art side of that world.
A wee bit of melody. I mixed a few punk bands there. One band I loved was The Saints, Australian band.
Well, they had a little bit extra going for them.
Yeah, yeah.
But Slaughter and the Dogs and Slaughter things like that. That wasn't really my cup of tea.
I like punk with a little melody there. You know, a little something.
Exactly. We're old boys here. We like a bit of melody.
what was the turning point where you started getting really big checks? Just to be vulgar.
Big checks was I was you too, yeah. Really. Because I don't know the contracts I signed with fucking Richard Branson with bands like XTC and the members, but I know that I really got nothing for them. And those records did not cost very much to make. Richard Branson was not, I mean, give me Chris Blackwell any day. People listening now, they're going, well, what the fuck? Who are those two? But there was a time in the early 80s where Blackwell and Branson were sort of vying for, you know, Virgin Records and Island Records were sort of similar hippie homes, I suppose. And for me, Chris Blackwell is one of the most honorable, beautiful men I've ever met. You know, absolutely, you know. I told you when Kirsty was killed, I got the phone call and I thought I need to get to Mexico and I phoned Chris Blackwell and told him, and he said, Steve, my plane is waiting for you. I mean, he was just a gentleman. You know, 15 minutes later, I was on my way to Teterboro Airport because there were it was too late for me to get a scheduled flight and my kids were there on their own and their mum had just been killed.
Oh my goodness.
So I had to get down there and Chris Blackwell really, really just came to the but not just that, you know, he was just honorable in all ways. You know, he was the good guy.
Yeah.
Whereas Richard Branson, I always felt that, you know, Thatcher had to have some example of her brave new union-free England to be successful. So she gave Branson a real wide berth to be as successful as he wanted. You know, only he got Virgin out of Heathrow. You know, no one else could ever get a Heathrow for their aeroplanes, but Thatcher may. Anyway, that's my whole thing about Branson, who's just he's just a bit of a...
Yeah.
Anyway, about Richard Branson. But I didn't get much money from them, from those records, and neither did the band. And, you know, Andy Partridge is still relatively bitter about it. But no, you two, I got some nice money. And you know, I've been lucky, Frank, that the records I've made have always had a pretty good catalogue thing. It's not like I never did Britney Spears, which was, you know, which would have been a huge payday in one go. But, you know, who buys a Britney Spears record now? Except for Hit Me Baby One More Time, maybe. But in general, you know, and Toxic. Toxic's another good one. It's still okay. It's pennies, not dollars anymore. But
yeah, the business has changed.
Yeah, but look, I no one deserves a living. I mean, Brian Eno had a great quote. He said the actual times in the human race where we have monetized music has been like just virtually no time at all.
Yeah.
You know, no one made records until CD money from records really until CDs came along. You know, I mean, The Who never made, Pete Townsend told me, he never made any money until like the 90s, you know, because they were always just, you know, I mean, it's half their fault when you smash up hotel rooms and do all that stuff. But really, people didn't make that much money early on. And it's back now. People don't make so much money from recorded music.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with any of these artists you worked with? Do you still hear from them? You only hear from them when they want you, right?
No, well, yes, that's obviously, you know, everyone, I speak to Adam Clayton a fair bit. Obviously, Nigel from the members is my best friend.
Yeah.
Dave Matthews, no, never, but he never really talks to anyone. He's a stranger. David Byrne, no. Chris and Tina are obviously on Facebook. Not Jerry Harrison either. How is Jerry Harrison? Is he okay?
Jerry's doing okay. He lives in Mill Valley, not far from me at the moment, but I'm about to move.
I know. That's why we're doing this.
I'm going to the mountains.
I know. That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic air.
Yeah.
It's going to be good for your health, Mr. Gallagher.
I'm looking forward to do a bit of fishing.
Yeah.
I'll be 50 miles from the Grand Canyon. So
I thought you were going to say you'll be 50 years old. I go, fuck off.
No, a little bit older than that. So here's one thing. How did you get into the Pogues? How did that come about?
Get into the Pogues?
No, the Pogues.
How did I get the Pogues?
No.
I've never had the Pogues.
No, St. Mary's Paddington.
Scabs, dear, yes, scabies. Yeah, yes, yeah, I've had scabies. Yeah. But we talked about that yesterday.
Yeah.
How did I get into the Pogues? Well, Frank Murray, of course. I was in Dublin helping the U2s with Joshua Tree. And Frank Murray was in the at Windmill Lane and popped by, and I knew him vaguely from Kirsty, but not very, very well. He was with the Pogues and said, "Steve, I know this is left field for you because you don't really do this sort of music, but would you like to work with the Pogues?" And I went, "Wow, that would be fantastic. I mean, that's a challenge." And I do love a challenge because, you know, one thing, Frank, that I've never done is whenever I've had success with one artist, I've never done another artist that sound, you know, The Alarm asked me to do pretty much every one of their albums. And it was like, man, as much as I love you, Mike Peters, you're a lovely man, but I don't really want to do your band because you're not as good as Big Country or U2, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't, you know, you may say Big Country, U2 and Simple Minds were similar, but they sort of weren't. They had different, I mean, you know, I certainly none of them had, no, they were, I'll say they weren't different. They were of a certain, you know, say alternative rock style. But, you know, as you know, in those days, there was so much variance in what bands were doing, you know. And now maybe there's all the best songs have been written and all the best sounds have been invented. It's very difficult for a band to make up new sounds.
Yeah, yeah. I work with the B-52s who have some great hits and. They're in a style and they're still playing very, very, very well. You know, but there's nobody like them.
Absolutely. I know. I've always said Fred has the best unmusical voice I've ever heard.
And a very funny man. A very funny.
I would think he's hilarious. I would think, I know what I'm like. If I'm... No, lovely. I'm sure, you know, you can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell there's joy in that band.
Yeah, I'll give you a Fred quip. I was outside the bus one night. We were in the south in Alabama, so it was like 90 degrees, and we were going to drive all night somewhere. So I'm standing outside the bus. I've got black shorts on, black shirt, ready for my bunk, and I've got a pair of black Crocs on. And Fred walked up to me and said, "Gee, Frank, what you doing? Practicing birth control?" like nobody will come near you.
Exactly. I know what I'm like when I'm near those sorts of really nice gay people. I just turn into sort of one of them. I mean, I'm not gay, but I just, you know, you flirt with them, and it's just great.
Yeah,
the world would be so much worse without gay people.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I'm immersed in that culture. So back to the Pogues. Did you have any Irish music in your background growing up?
Not with the name Lily White. No. But, you know, at that point, I'd had 100%, pretty much 100%. You know, I'd done Simple Minds, I'd done Big Country, I'd done U2. I get Celts, you know.
Yeah.
And Kirsty, of course, who was, you know, her dad was Ewan McColl, who was Scottish, although born in Manchester.
Yeah.
So there was very much a Scottish thing with Kirsty as well. And, you know, I loved the Pogues. It was, you know, I got them at their height, I think.
That was a great album.
It's a fantastic album. And of course,
great songs.
And I remember Spider looking at me at the end of, we had a playback at the end of the album. Spider looked at me and said, "How the fuck did we do that?"
Yeah.
Because, you know, this was what when I'm a good producer, I allow things to happen without being a dictator, and I guide without being, you know, and allow them to be exactly what they want to be, and gently just bring them back when they're not. You know, with the Pogues, it was some very simple things. You know, you don't get them to do backing tracks anytime after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, you get them in early and you get them to play for breakfast, because after that they start getting sloppy. I would never book the Pogues to play at midnight.
No.
You know, Terry Woods, he'd be fucked.
Shane
is different, because Shane is a true bohemian. Shane may well wake up at 11 o'clock at night and go straight on stage. You don't know with Shane. That's the thing, you know. Shane really, he a real bohemian, and I mean it, you know. He didn't matter where he slept. If he woke up at 8 in the morning, it would be purely purely coincidental. It could be 8 in the morning, 8 at night, 2 in the morning, didn't matter. You know, so Shane was slightly different. But to get the bands to do their parts, I would get them in early.
Yeah, I love that Fall from Grace with God record. That was
I was very, very, very lucky classic. To produce that one.
Yeah. And you did some stuff with the Rolling Stones.
I did the worst ever Rolling Stones album.
Yeah.
Until the one that came after. And the one that came after that. I learned a lot from the Rolling Stones. I'm not sure if they learned a lot from me, but I knew it wasn't going to be their greatest album, but a real man never turns down the Stones, right?
Right.
You know, I had to do it. I won the lottery to get the job. And it was, you know, there was a few good moments. I think Harlem Shuffle was a passable single. One Hit to the Body was an okay song, but mostly as an album. They never toured it, and it just sort of came and went, you know. But through that, I spoke to, you know, I got good friends with Keith, and ended up going to record Keith and Aretha Franklin doing Jumping Jack Flash for the movie Jumping Jack Flash. And, you know, to say you recorded Aretha Franklin is something that is right up there on my my things I'm proud of, I have to say.
Well, I think the last time I saw you in person, I came by the studio in New York when you were working Spider-Man, the musical.
Well, this was the phone call Bono made to me that I wish he hadn't. I mean, you know, it was an okay musical. I don't want to say too much about it.
No,
because
But I
because it,
I remember
certain,
your demeanor.
There's certain rules. Yeah, there are certain rules that you need to do when you're doing a musical, and that is, you know, most musicals are rewritten, are being, you know, and there's ways of doing it, and I there was just a lot of things that didn't work out. This was a great example of putting the best band with the best director with the most money and not necessarily coming out with the best product. And that's, you know, that's what music is all about for me, that X factor. It can go wrong, and that's what I love about it. You know, I've always said you can put the best band with the best producer in the best studio and come out with a turkey. And And, you know, I'm not saying Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark was a turkey, but it, you know, it had some great moments, but it never 100% got off the ground for many, many, many reasons. You know, both technical,
It had a few feathers.
Yeah. Both creative and technical and, you know, there you go. Yeah. So, but hey, no one bats a thousand.
You can't win them all.
You can't win them all, as they say in American sports. Yeah. Look, we'll keep in touch.
All right, my son. Thank you so much.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Good luck. Bye. Ta-da. Hey, thanks for plugging in. We can't do without you. And if you can, please consider supporting the show so that we can keep it running through 2021. Go to our website at soundmanconfidential.com to find the link and to check out our amazing upcoming guest list. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black and Chet Bentley, web design by Adelaide Bell, original music by Paul Westwater, and publicity by Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.